This is like the LOM REM, the whole LOM REM, and maybe, oh well, only a few of you are going to get it. Sorry. But you know what? It's, I only have three. But it's got, this is from Geshe Rabchin's book, and it's really cool. It's got every bit of the LOM REM. It's three pages long. Chart one, chart two, chart three. But, you know, whenever you come here, you get a teaching, you go, how does that fit into this, into the big picture? It's confusing. And so this chart will thoroughly confuse you. Hopefully not. But anyway, it's, you know, everything that's important is in there. Now, I also have another handout that I might, I might give you if I have enough copies of it. Sort of scare you. It's a good place to being. There might be enough of these. You want to see? Maybe you could share. So, what is a? Does anybody know what Kadampa means? You get extra credit if you get this right.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, like hearing every word of the Buddha as personal advice for you. Like the Buddha's talk, everything, every bit of Dharma is it's personal advice for us. Okay? And so the these great teachers that lived, I can't remember when. Well, Atisha lived around the 10th century. So, you know, that was, and he was the founder of the Kadampa lineage. And he, one of the features of the Kadampa masters was they were renowned for their awareness of death and impermanence. Doesn't that sound great? I mean, you come here to hear about dying and death and impermanence, but you think about it, you know, they always remembered death in the morning so they wouldn't waste the afternoon. And they remembered death in the afternoon so they wouldn't waste the night. And so, you know, awareness, you know, the teachings say we should be aware of death and impermanence at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end of any activity. Because in the beginning, it gets us going, and in the middle, it keeps us going, and at the end, we want to do it well. Like, so having an awareness of death and impermanence is, from a spiritual perspective anyway, it's a great thing. Most people, most of us, I can't speak for everybody though, but I know a lot of people in this culture, you know, we don't like to think about death, you know. That's, you know, we kind of push it away, we really, you know, don't, and it's something everybody's going to have to face, but somehow we don't want to talk about it. And we don't shy away from it at Kadampa Center. We even talk about how to die well, you know, how to die with a peaceful mind. Well, I think Joanna has left, so. Buddhist funerals. It's pretty loose. Pretty loose. Like, for example, when I was in Thailand and at the Buddha, at the, it's not so much like in Christianity where you go to the church and ceremony or whatever, but like in Thailand, they cremate the bodies, right? And so they have a little outdoor crematorium at every monastery, and they'll bring the body there and the family. And what they told me was usually there's a party while the body's burning. Yeah, they're showing videos, and it's more like a celebration than so they. I'm sure there's sadness too, for sure, because people lose people, but. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, and sometimes things are said and sometimes not. I went to the cremation of the Dalai Lama's, one of his brothers who died when I was living in India at the time. And it was early in the morning and thousands of people were there, and not much was said. It was just the body was brought out, cremated, and, you know, that was it. Yeah. The next life, exactly. Very important. The time of death is really crucial.
There's something in Tibet. They wait 47 days, something like that, and then of course they dismember the body and feed it to the.
Well, they don't wait 47 days to do that, but the consciousness can stay in the Bardo for 49 days, actually. Yeah. They'll get, you know, as soon as the consciousness has left the body, which, you are really getting off on tangents, but that's okay. There are stories, and, you know, this is, again, there's a whole module on death and dying, but there's stories of people dying and their consciousness, because they're great meditators, they've been able to keep their consciousness in their body, no pulse, no respirations, you know, no brainwave, no, the EEGs would be flatline, right? But the consciousness is said to still be in the body. This is what, you know, what is thought to be happening. So, interestingly, the body doesn't decay, and it stays fresh and, you know, doesn't decay for up to weeks. So they've had a few meditators who've died in South India where it's pretty warm. And so the bodies would start decaying pretty quickly, but they would stay kind of fresh for weeks while these people would be in their death meditation. And it's sad, because at the moment of death, if you can capture the subtlest moment of the subtlest level of consciousness, so-called the clear-light consciousness, if you can capture that without and not freak out, but, you know, you practice a lot of these tantric practices, particularly Hatha Yoga Tantra, you practice six times a day if you're doing it the right way, you know, the whole process of dying, and then, so right up to this clear light death. So these beings have sort of, you know, basically sustained the clear light consciousness in their, and within this physical body, even though everything else is dead. They can keep it in the body for a long period of time, and they can purify eons of negative karma. It's said that you can actually achieve enlightenment at the time of death. And so these yogis that have practiced their whole lives are, you know, in preparation for death. I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard it said that they look forward to death like we look forward to going to a picnic. I have a problem. It's hard to believe that, but it is a nice, it's a good selling point. And it might be true. You know, there's, let's put it this way. I think I would think that they die more peacefully, definitely. You know, because they prepared for it. And they've lived their lives in a meaning, you know, their lives have been meaningful. I think that's really the thing that freaks people out more than anything, is that they haven't lived well, you know, lived a good life in the sense, you know, we'll talk about it in a minute. You know, death is definite, right?
I think there's a book on that, Tibetan book of living and dying.
Mm-hmm. Sogyal Rinpoche wrote that book many years ago, that quite very famous book. Okay. She's bail, so I'll read this. I'll read it, and maybe she'll bring it. She's trying to get a copying machine. But anyway, this is called Encouragement Through Recollecting Impermanence. And There's actually this is a text. It's like, I don't know, 5 or 10 pages long, but this is only one page that I like this. It's by Prabhakar Rinpoche, the same person who wrote Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. All the hurt, kind Lama, looked at this pitiful one, how I behave and how I have cheated myself my entire life. Please look upon this mindless one with compassion. The essential advice to give yourself, heart spoon, I don't know what that means, keep it deep within your heart. Don't be distracted. Don't be distracted. Reflect upon the state of your life from the essential drop at your heart. Since beginning with cyclic existence, which hasn't ended up till now, though you've experienced countless cycles of rebirth, just so many variations on happiness and pain, you've achieved not the slightest of benefit from them. And though at present you've attained leisure and fortune, so difficult to find, always till now, they've finished and been lost, have been empty and without meaning. Now, if you care about yourself, the time has come to practice the essence of future happiness, virtuous actions. You appear so capable, smart, clever, but you're a fool. As long as you cling to the child's play of the appearances of this life, suddenly you're overwhelmed by the fearful Lord of death, and without hope or means to endure, there's nothing you can do. This is going to happen to you. That's kind of how he's saying it. Now, don't be distracted. Right this moment is the time to steel your will. It is not only time, it's almost too late. Right now, right now. Apply yourself with great force. Holy precept of the Lama, kind Father, heart of the authoritative scriptures of the victorious Losang, practice of the pure path of complete sutra and tantra, is time to place real experience upon your mind stream. Who's the faster, Yama the Lord of Death, or you in your practice of realizing the essence of your eternal dream, the welfare of both yourself and others, as much as you can each day? Unifying the three doors of your body, speech, and mind, put the whole of your effort into your practice. So this is a great thing to read at the beginning of your day, you know, just to start out your meditation practice, because it really, it's like, wow, he's right. This life is so short. It could end. And now if we want to make any progress in our spiritual life, we have to seize the moment. We cannot just keep lollygagging. It's not, this game, you know, it's not going to go on forever. This thing called my life. Okay. So let's, since I'm going to give a commentary, a little bit of commentary on the foundation of all good qualities, let's read the three principal aspects of the path together first. Okay. And, now this is a synopsis of the Lamrim, by the way, of the key points of the Lamrim. But you know, it's packaged so many ways. You know, the foundation of all good qualities is the Lamrim prayer. This is a really famous Lamrim prayer. And you know, there's bunches of different Lamrim texts. Lama Tsongkhapa wrote the Lamrim Chenmo, which is like two big, thick volumes long. And then there's a medium-length Lamrim, and then a short-length Lamrim, sometimes called the Lines of Experience. So there's different versions of it, but knowing these short prayers is very helpful. Okay, we'll start out with, I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning, the victorious ones' teachings, the path praised by all the holy victors and their children, the gateway of the fortunate ones desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones. You fortunate ones, listen with a calm mind. Without the complete intention definitely to be free from circling, there is no way to pacify attachment seeking pleasurable effects in the ocean of circling. Also, by craving for cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find, and life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again that actions and their effects are unbetraying, and repeatedly contemplating the miseries of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When, by having trained in that way, there is no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, if it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it does not become the cause of the perfect bliss of unsurpassed enlightenment. Therefore, the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, taut in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped in the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all mothers are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. In short, if like the mother whose cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity, your reflections on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for even 1 second, and the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort, then you have realized supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you generated renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of circling. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent arising. One who sees the cause and effect of all phenomena of both cyclic existence and the state beyond sorrow, and for whom unbetraying, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetraying, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relation as completely unbetraying, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects are apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points, the three principal aspects of the path, resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child. So. All right, so now we're going to leap into the foundation of all good qualities. And I'm losing my place. I thought as I was preparing for this, I think we'll stop in here and do a little meditation, maybe a 3-minute meditation here, 3-minute meditation there. We'll see. But I think you need to understand the whole path, right, including Tantra. So I really want to touch on these points here. Now, some things are not covered in great detail that are in the lower scope, like refuge is not, but a lot of things are. So we'll just go through this. Now, this commentary, by the way, you can get this online, right? I mentioned that to you. I think it's Lamayashi Wisdom Archive. They did it, and you just If you Google commentary on the foundation of all good qualities, you can download this. It's really nice, and it's a transcript of a teaching given, I believe it was in Kathmandu at Kopan Monastery, and this particular person, his name was Khuna Lama Rinpoche, and he was a layman, but the Dalai Lama was one of his students. So it's not like everybody who teaches at a very high level in the Tibetan tradition necessarily had to be a monastic. He was not a monastic. He was, I think he was married, or at least he had a girlfriend. And I think, anyway, they hung out together. And he was very renowned and dressed like a pauper and not arrogant at all, but extremely educated and had a lot of meditative experience. All right, so the first line. Remember, we talked about the importance of the teacher. So the first line, the foundation of all good qualities, is the. We could actually read the lines together. First, read this stanza together. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So, you know, why do we need a guru? Why do we need a teacher? It's sort of obvious, isn't it? It's sort of obvious, but then it's not so obvious because look how people are homeschooled all the time. Yeah, you don't need a teacher. Just take the book. But, you know, in Buddhism we say when it only lives in the books, it's not... I'm sorry if anybody homeschools. I didn't mean to offend you. But homeschooling is great. But I think it's good to have a living example. Like when, you know, when I sit up here and say this, I don't have a lot of experience. But when Geshe Gelug says the same words, they land deeper for a lot of people. And the Dalai Lama shows up, you know, you really pay attention because, you know, he walks the talk. So that's the point. The teacher is a great example of what we can accomplish. So to give us confidence that the path is actually going to take us somewhere, that this is not something dreamed up by some hippie on an acid trip in the 60s. Sorry if I offended anybody. In California, okay, I'll go there. You know, it's the test of thousands of years of being handed down from teacher to, you know, from teacher to student who realized the teachings and so on and so forth. So it's I'll say this. I think in a real way, I'm trying to think of my relationship with Lama Zopa, who's my guru. You know, I consider him my teacher, and Lama Yeshe, also I knew him and felt that way about him. And I think, I almost liken it to God in other religions, but it's kind of like your teacher sort of, you know, in Buddhism it's an organic process. You can't just say, you know, this teacher is God, or this teacher is, you know, worthy of respect, or whatever. You can, but normally it's something that you grow into because you get the teachings and you put them in. You know, you're happy to get them, but you don't really know what you're getting because you haven't practiced them. Then you practice the teachings, and then you know people see their mind shifting. I mean, their suffering is diminished, and their calmness and their ability to be with people and with themselves and just the whole character of their lives changes, and there's such a feeling of appreciation and really love for the person who gave you these teachings, not just the historical Buddha but the living teacher, you know, the person that gave you these teachings. And so I think, and then that really lives in your heart and inspires you. I know, for example, Rubina was talking about how she you know, how Lama Zopa is her teacher, and she really keeps him in her heart all the time. It's almost like, okay, Rinpoche, what would you do now? Which is not a bad way to live, by the way. You know, how would your teacher handle this? You know, would he like smack this person, or would they try to find another way to handle it? So, you know, I think the importance of the teacher, I mean, in everything we've ever done, we've had teachers, but in particularly in your spiritual life, if this, I'm just saying if, you know, like you people don't really believe this, but let's say if this is really the biggest game in town, which is called your life and how to make it work and how to be happy and use it in the most meaningful way, and then prepare yourself for the next life and the one after that and the one after that. If it's that important, you better pick a good teacher. You better not pick somebody that says, you know, go fly a plane into a huge building and, you know, kill yourself and a bunch of, you know, you want somebody who's got good, who you check them out, they're motivated by wisdom and compassion, you trust them, you know, you really, really are willing to use them as a guide. And if your teacher ever told you to do something non-virtuous, you wouldn't do it. You'd say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And in the Vajrayana tradition of Buddhism, it's really, 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 really important to have a qualified teacher that you can entrust yourself to. Because we're really talking about the difference between rowing a boat and flying the Concorde. And you better have somebody who knows how to fly the Concorde sitting in the co-pilot seat while you're learning. Yeah.
Do the gurus have the gurus have to have a certain level? Do they have to be monks or nuns?
No. No. Kunalama Rinpoche was not a monk, right?
Are you a guru, Robbie?
Robbie's a guru. I'm not. Robbie's my guru. No, my kids are my gurus, actually. That's what a... Well, you know what? The guru means teacher, someone who's heavy with qualities. That's another term, way that term is translated. And there's a whole list of qualities that are for the ideal. They're in the foundation of all good qualities of the ideal guru. And unfortunately, neither Robbie nor I qualify. I qualify only as a facilitator. Robbie is actually a teacher. I'm just a facilitator. Vajrayana. Tantra. What now? Well, there's a module called Introduction to Tantra at the end of this course. So, and I'm the only one that's ever taught that module, simply because I'm just pretty sure that I'm going to the hell realm, and so nobody else wants to take a chance. Anyway. Yeah, so if I mess it up, it's not that big a deal. But Vajrayana is called the... I'll say a little bit about it right now. It's the speedy path to enlightenment. But it only works if you got the foundation of all good quality, the three principal aspects of the path. It only works if you have that in your heart. Okay? You have some feeling for renunciation and bodhicitta and the correct view of emptiness. If you have that in your heart, not just the words, you know, not just you memorize it, but you have that in your heart. And here's the hooker. You are so compassionate that you can't bear the suffering of sentient beings another moment. You want to get on the Concorde and get over there as quick as you can. You don't want to row a boat. You know, it takes 16 countless eons to get there. And, you know, in the Sutrayana, the Vajrayana, you can do it in one lifetime. So, you know, you want to go in one lifetime, but you're motivated by compassion for others. you're looking for the speediest path, the speediest way to do it. And so it's called the resultant path, where we, you know, this deity yoga, where you imagine you dissolve everything into the space of emptiness. You imagine yourself as a perfect being now, as a Buddha now. See, right now, we just think we're a mess. You know, I mean, we do. Well, some of us may know, but, you know, we criticize ourselves quite severely. You know, we're always putting ourselves down, comparing ourselves to other people. Oh, I could never get enlightened. Are you kidding me? That is impossible. We have a spiritual inferiority complex like you wouldn't believe. We don't have any faith that we could develop, you know, perfect love, compassion, kindness, you know, generosity, all the qualities, power, all the qualities of an enlightened being. We don't have any faith we can do that. But in Vajrayana, we dissolve all of our ordinary sense of I and self into the space of emptiness. And then we imagine that we arise as a perfect being, and we identify with that being, and we meditate on having that quality now. So we're taking the future result and bringing it into the moment. Also known as fake it till you make it. And I mean in business they talk about that a lot, don't they? Like that's what mission statements are about. You're not your job's mission statement, but you want to be. So if you could imagine that you're living the mission statement now, even though that's not where your head is, that helps speed you along the path in terms of actually being that kind of person. So it's the same way with Vajrayana, is this very technologically advanced methodology for transforming the mind. A lot of these images behind us, like Tara, green Tara, this is, if you want to develop, this is a green lady here, all of these Tara statues, but she symbolizes compassion. And green, when you see the green light, what do? Go! So the energy of compassion is action. Okay, and then let's see. Over here is blue. This is the medicine Buddha, the healing Buddha. And there's something about the colors, that colors affect your mind, right? Colors do affect our mind. So this is the particular guru, the medicine Buddha. So there's a whole tantric practice around that deity. And then there's other ones. And then there's, in highest yoga tantra, oftentimes you have a male and female, in union, and symbolizing the union of method and wisdom, the union of male and female energy, union of bliss and emptiness. There's huge symbology around all of these tantric images, and some people get a little freaked out by it, but that's, you know, what it's about. You know, it's about transforming the mind. That's not a get enlightened. That's precious human rebirth.
Okay.
But enlightenment's even more difficult.
The message is, you've got a snowball's chance in hell of ever having a precious human rebirth.
No, you got one. Right now.
But the next one.
The next one, you're creating the causes right now for the next one by being here tonight.
Okay, but the metaphor is...
Yeah, but those are for the people...
The turtle's finding this ring. You
know? You're right, because it's very easy to go down. I mean, and not create the causes for a precious human rebirth. Okay? Throwing the sticks on the ground and spelling your name perfectly, in like Garamond. Not going to be easy. Yeah, it's not going to be easy. That's the point. The point is, when you meditate on precious human rebirth, is that, wow, not everybody who's a human being has a precious human rebirth. They may have a healthy body and mind, and may not live in a barbaric country, and they may not be demented or... you know, all those kinds of things, and have all their faculties. But, you know, but here we are, we've met the Dharma, we've met the teachers, we, for some weird reason, who knows why, but you have an interest. Now maybe you'll never come back here again, and that's perfectly okay. I mean, people come and go all the time. But you have an interest, and you have a little desire to put it into practice, and maybe over time even more and more. So the more desire you have to put it in practice, and then you get to see the benefits of it if you do put it into practice. And so, you know, we live at a time when there are teachers that can teach it through examples of the teachings, and we have places like Kadampa Center, you know, and I mean, like an oasis to me. For me, this place is like an oasis in a desert. You know, it's like, it's so nice to be able to come here and be around people that I feel safe around Kadampa people, you know, because I know most of them have taken a vow not to kill, and, you know. And to be kind, you know, there's an emphasis here on kindness and compassion. I mean, isn't that the kind of people you want to be around? You know, and they also, we also kind of fluff each other's aura. And you come here to meditate. It's a lot easier to meditate with other people than to try to do it on your own. It's a lot easier to practice. So, all right, I've said enough about that. All right, let's do the next stanza. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. Well, there we go, precious human rebirth. We were just talking about it. The 8 freedoms and the 10 endowments. So take a minute and let's do a little 2-minute think about the precious, you know, about, you know, do you really live your life as if it's precious? And if it is precious, we're saying it's precious because you can achieve every dream you ever had for yourself and other people by transforming your mind. That's the real take-home message. Think about that. So this perfect human rebirth gives us a chance of continuing to be reborn in the realms of woe, of suffering in future lives, or a chance to attain supreme enlightenment. It offers every possibility. And we should use it to attain our highest potentials. And really rejoice in the fact that you created causes for it. And pray that you will have another one in the next life. you know, that you will meet the Dharma again and be able to continue on this path and make progress. If you don't achieve enlightenment this time, you definitely want to be back in on this path in future lifetimes. And so, you know, tonight you can relax. So tonight, all we're doing, all we ever do at Kadampa Center is plant seeds. So tonight we're planting the seeds. You know, we're just, you know, planting seeds. So we'll keep right on planting until 9 o'clock. I'll have to go get my daughter. Okay. Now, let's read the next one. This life is as impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow follows the body, the results of negative karma follow. So two things, right? That's pretty clear. First one is what? Death and impermanence. And how quickly it comes. So our meditation on death, we did that last week. So let's do that again. Death is definite, remember? Death is definite. Time of death is indefinite. And the only thing of any benefit when we're dying is the kind of mind we have. I mean, are we going to freak out? Are we going to be calm? Are we going to be happy? Is it even possible to die with a happy mind? Buddhism would say, yeah, it is. And it's really important to die with a happy mind. Not only is it possible, but it's important because it's the chief determinant of the next life. The mind at the last moment of this life is the chief throwing karma for the next life. So we really, you know, and any moment could be the last moment. So let's stay positive, people. You know, let's try to be positive. All right. So let's do this meditation on death briefly. So everybody has died. There's nobody that gets out of here alive. Although Robert Thurman said, nobody's going to get out of here dead. It's because we're all going to come back again and again and again. But for the purposes of this meditation, it's, you know, this life will come to an end. There's no doubt that we will die. We don't think, we live our life like we're never going to die. Intellectually, we know we're going to die. But when we look really deep down inside, we don't think we're going to die. We don't think it's going to really happen to me. The ego, that sense of permanence that we cling to so tightly, it really doesn't want to believe it. So, since we're going to die, we need to turn our mind toward the Dharma. That's the conclusion. And then, the time of death is completely random. The young die before the old. You know, babies die, teenagers die, people in every stage of their lives can die. It's not just the octogenarians, you know, and the people in the nursing homes. Anybody can die at any moment. You know, you breathe in, you breathe out, and you don't breathe in again. That's what we call death. Just a breath away. happen at any moment. So the conclusion is that I must practice the Dharma, and I must practice it now with a sense of urgency. Don't procrastinate. Don't put it off until tomorrow or this summer when I have some time. But, you know, let's try to practice 24/7. Have a whole life be an expression of our Dharma commitment. And then last point is the only thing that's of any benefit, the only currency we can spend on our deathbed or at the moment of our death are the spiritual realizations, that the seeds that we planted on our consciousness. And the conclusion is, I mean, it's pretty obvious that that's the case. And the conclusion is that since that is the case, and we do want to die well, even if we don't even believe in future lifetimes, who wouldn't want to die with a peaceful mind? Something we all have to face. So the only, you know, the conclusion is I must practice the Dharma and practice it purely and with sincerity and with some energy. You know, I must give it a priority in my life. Okay. And now the second half of that line was about after death, like the shadow follows the body, results of negative and positive karma ensue. And we'll do the next one. Let's do the next stanza together. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest of negativities and to accomplish all virtuous deeds. So, you know, this has something to do with karma, and so to not steal again Robbie's thunder but you know, we talked a lot about karma, didn't we? And just briefly, I'm going to say the kind of the key points that I think, you know, we need to remember about karma is that if you plant a watermelon seed, you're not going to get a banana plant. If you plant a little seed of kindness, it will ripen in future kindness, you know, being shown to you. Okay? Well, let's talk about how things ripen. They ripen, could be a future kindness being shown to you, right? It could ripen in the habit to be kind. So, it could also have, your kindness also creates the kind of people in the world you live in, the kind of people that are going to be around you. So, sort of, in a sense, kindness is what's holding the walls of Gaudapas that are up. If it's karma, if all this is our karma ripening all the time. So, you know, kindness, it really creates the people and the situations and environment, you know, the positive ones that we see. And then kindness also will create the kind of life that we step into in the future. For example, if you're kind, the chances are you're going to have a good life in the future. And if you're mean and nasty, the chances are you're going straight to hell. And I'm not joking. I mean, Buddhism talks like that. That there's a heaven, and I mean, not a heaven, but the joyless realms are the places you don't want to be. And these are not like, you know, some people think it's just some hooey, you know, it's just some mind game that the Buddhists are playing. But the Buddha taught it, and it might be true. And It helps my mind to think that it's true, because every time I create the causes to go to hell, I clean them up real quick as I can, you know? I think, wow, I don't want to suffer any more than I already am. I got enough on my plate. So it's kind of like that. So being aware of, so that, you know, there's a result similar to the cause, so we could have kind things done to us or bad things done to us. If we kill somebody, we could be killed, right? In the future lives, if we kill somebody, we might have the habit to kill again. In the future, you know, the environment that we lived in, if we kill somebody, would be like being around a lot of murderers and mean people, and there wouldn't be much food and a lot of illness and stuff like that. There'd be a lot of environmental effects. And then the future life would be hell. And that's the karma of killing. So those are the results. So the positive leads to positive, negative leads to negative. Remember how we define virtue in Buddhism? How do we define it? Anybody? Sandra Robbie? Pardon? It's more than that. Yeah.
It has positive future results.
Yeah. If the result is happiness, the action was virtuous. And we're not talking about short-term results. We're talking about long-term results, okay? Because it's looking at the big picture. Because, like we said, you know, if you're a murderer, a serial killer, you know, you might get a kind of a charge out of, might you think, well, that's, I'm happy killing people, but, you know, and that happiness would have to have a cause, which would be virtuous. But the long-term effect of killing is negativity, would be hell, would be a very hellacious kind of life in the future. So anyway, you get the point. All right, so positive leads to positive, negative leads to negative. And then little tiny seeds. Look at that, you know, look at those big trees out there. They start out little tiny seeds. So the tiniest action can give huge consequences. So there's never a moment when we can take our guard down and not protect our mind. Every moment is important to plant the seeds for happiness, and important to not plant seeds for future suffering. You know, we're just casting them out. All right now, just listen to the teachings. You're planting seeds. You know, that's all we're doing tonight. That's all we ever do at Kadampa Center, is plant seeds. And this is what it's about. We want seeds for happiness. We don't want seeds for suffering, right? And they grow exponentially. So that's why if you make a mess, clean it up quickly. Don't wait 3 years to say I'm sorry to somebody that you were rude to. And if you've got a lot of unfinished business out there, like in AA, I know they tell people to go around and call all the people that you did, you know, that you messed with, that you screwed over, you know, in your lifetime. And that's supposed to be a really important part of that whole 12-step program, is to clean up the messes. So again, because karma expands, don't waste your time, don't waste a lot of time. Purify as quickly as possible. So the 10 non, so this last stanza also referred to the 10 non-virtuous actions. So there are three of body, four of speech, and three of mind. Who wants to take a shot at the 10 non-virtues? Killing is wait a minute now, three of body. Killing, stealing, and adultery. Sexual misconduct, sex with somebody else's partner is a whole big definition. Everybody wants the details of that one, but anyway, just take sexual misconduct. Most people know it, or as children says, unwise sexual behavior. That pretty much covers it, doesn't it? So killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Now the four of speech, lying. Anybody not know what lying is? Slander. Bad mouthing people. Oh, don't we like to do that? That's so much fun to, you know, talk bad, you know, it's like gossip, you know. Well, that's the next one. Lying, slander. No, harsh speech is the next one. Harsh speech and frivolous speech, which is really gossip. wasting people's time with meaningless conversation. Okay. So, divisive speech, wouldn't that be included in one of those? Harsh, you know, slander is divisive, yeah. Divisive because you're trying to, like if I was bad-mouthing Robbie to you, you know, I'd try to be getting you not to like Robbie. That's not slandering, you're just telling me the truth. Okay, alright, now, so this is, oh, three of Bonnie's feet, and then three of mine. We usually, this is sort of like greed, hatred, and ignorance is the easy way to say it, but greed, you know, this it's like attachment. So it's that heavy, you know, clingy attachment. Hatred or ill will. Everybody knows what that is. You know, it's really, and you know, you might think, well, I don't hate anybody. Well, what is the mind of aversion anyway? If you feel aversion to somebody, that is a form, you know, we wouldn't, the word hatred seems a little strong, doesn't it? But it is, hatred is just a mind of aversion, and there's a huge, you know, all the way up to, I hate his guts. There's all these different little levels of aversion that lead up to it. It's just a little, it's hatred wearing a, you know, a nicer suit of clothes. But aversion is what we're talking about. Right. So, and then closed-minded ignorance, it's more than, sometimes it's said, you know, it's said, well, it's disbelief in your potential to become a Buddha, for example, not believing in your potential, disbelief in the laws of karma, not having any faith in the teachings on emptiness, and so on and so forth. So there's that kind of ignorance. But really, I think at the deepest level, it's just the ignorance of reality, of how things truly exist. So greed, hatred, and ignorance are the three of mind. So lying, slander, sexual misconduct, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, slander, harsh, frivolous speech, greed, hatred, and ignorance, 10 non-virtuous actions. So it's important to memorize those, and then to meditate on them. Think about it. Well, you might say, well, I haven't killed anybody in this life, intentionally. Particularly those physicians here in the room, you know, they say it's hard not to have knocked somebody off in your lifetime, inadvertently. But, I got carried away here for a second. About killing. What was I talking about? Meditate on them. Yeah. You might think, well, I've never killed anybody. But in past lives, you were a mass murderer. Right? You made Jeffrey Dahmer look like a nobody. You know, we've all done everything. This is the attitude we need to have. We've all been, you know, great, you know, spiritual beings, but we didn't get to the point where we wouldn't fall back down. We've all been the worst of the worst. We just don't remember it. So it's better not to criticize others because we've probably been worse than them in past lifetimes. So it's just something to keep in mind. All right, moving along here. Seeking sensoric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. All right, now, make sure I cover all the. So we sort of left the lower scope behind here with this one, because this one deals with the middle scope of liberation or nirvana. But seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. There's another saying that they have in Buddhism. They say that we see things. I have to say this right. We race toward the cause of suffering as if it were something worthwhile. We race toward it like it's something worthwhile. And we repulse the things that could actually liberate us. We push them away. Now, how many people before they came to Kadampa Center would think that excitement is a problem? I'm going to Disney World next week. I'm going to have fun. My kids are too. We're going to Universal Studios. We're going to get excited. We're going to have fun. But I know something now that I didn't know when I was younger. What am I talking about here? What is the problem with excitement, with pleasure, with attachment? Why is that a problem? Yeah, it agitates the mind. It says anything that, and it's short term, it doesn't last. Anything that destabilizes our mind, that keeps our mind from being able to focus and to be it, to abide in a calm, focused way, is considered to be unhealthy. Kind of weird, isn't it? That would be defined as something to be avoided. So excitement is not necessarily a good thing, even though in our culture we live for it. My God, you won't believe how many people are going to be dropping major bucks down in Orlando next week, and I'll be one of them. But you know, it's all for this fix, this pleasurable moment. But here's what I think. I think that if we can enjoy things without the expectation that it's going to actually bring us happiness, it'll bring us pleasure, and we know it won't last. So there's a whole different mentality around enjoyment of pleasurable experiences when we don't think that it's the true cause of happiness, and we don't think that it's going to last, and we don't think that that's enough. Yeah, we don't project all kinds of, permanence and exaggerate its good qualities like we tend to do. Remember the eight worldly concerns, we talked about this, how we're addicted to the four pleasurable things. We're addicted to deliciousness. That's how we say it in Buddhism. We're addicted to deliciousness. Deliciousness is gain, pleasure, gain, praise and fame. We're addicted, and everything comes into that. Everything you can ever imagine is in that column, deliciousness. And what do we hate? Because we're addicted or so clingy to things that are delicious, if I cling to deliciousness, what do I hate? Bad tasting stuff, right? Anything that's the opposite of what I'm clinging to is something I feel aversion toward. So that's why this attachment creates aversion to the opposites. So attachment to pleasure creates an aversion to pain. Attachment or clinging to gain, aversion to loss. Fame and blame, praise, well, whatever. You get the point. So the point is that there's nothing wrong with being attached. There's nothing wrong with going to Disney World or having pleasurable experiences. Most people are married and have an intimate relationship. There's nothing wrong with any of that. It's just that we don't want to turn those experiences into the cause of future suffering. We want to bring some wisdom to the moments, to those experiences. That's what we want to do. So, all right. So he's saying samsaric pleasures are the door to all suffering. Uh-oh. Forget about your love life. No, I'm just kidding. No, but samsaric pleasures enjoyed with a samsaric mind, you know, is going to be the cause of future suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Liberation is nirvana. Liberation means freedom from suffering. It doesn't even imply you got anywhere. All you did was let go of suffering. Because attachment, isn't it? The antidote to attachment is what? Letting go. So all that an arhat does is just let go of suffering. And what's there when we let go of suffering is bliss. It's like bliss beyond belief. It's our nature. It's our basic nature to be blissful and happy. But it's just these layers of craziness and confusion that obscure that. All right, so, you know, holy beings have recognized temporal pleasures as a shortcoming of samsara, as faulty and deceptive. Okay, now we'll read the next one. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The Rudi teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Okay, so mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. So, what do we mean by mindfulness and alertness? They're really different terms. You know, mindfulness, we talk about, and I'm going to say it, you can read it different ways. A lot, and the word mindfulness is like, oh, it's defined by so many different people. Well, you know, it's, I think I know the definition in the Buddhist, in the Tibetan text called mind and mental factors, and you see it in other ones, but it's really, it's not letting go, it's being able to hold on to the object. Whatever you're paying attention to, you can pay attention to it 100%. You know, we can hold on to the object without losing it. Okay? With the rope of mindfulness kind of thing, or the hook of mindfulness. And alertness is one of the aspects of our consciousness, of our mind, that's looking to see when we're distracted or when some disturbance has arisen in the mind. So we pay it, so we can, again, bring our mind back and pay attention with mindfulness. So we have to have, in a meditation practice, particularly mindfulness and alertness play a crucial part in being able to hold on to the object of meditation, don't they? We have to be able to hold on to it with a real stable mind. All right, so there. So mindfulness, alertness, great part. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. So there's like seven different levels of pratimoksha vows. So, you know, and some of them are monastic vows, and some of them are, you know, lay vows. So we just, at the first class, I don't know if you guys remember, but I said, as much as possible, try not to kill or steal or commit adultery. I think I said that. And lying. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lying, and then getting loaded. You know, for the obvious reasons that, you know, when we're intoxicated, we do a lot of stupid things. And what we want to do is wake up. We don't want to, like, make ourselves numbed out. So there you go. There are a lot of vows, though, in Buddhism. You get, and we see, when you hear the word vow, what do you normally think of when you hear the word vow? Do you think, wow, boy, freedom. Gosh, I'm going to take a vow, even to get married. You know, you take a vow. When you take a vow to get married, theoretically, you shouldn't be dating around. Right? It limits you. Don't we usually think of a vow as something that limits us? And it's something to be avoided, because we don't want to be limited. We want to be free and spontaneous and be able to do whatever we want to do. Most people don't look at vows as protecting us, as actually, these are actually called freedom vows. They're actually called freedom vows because they protect us from our delusions, our negative mind. You know, given, you know, if we just let the instincts go where they will, we know where that ends up. I mean, that's what the animals do, isn't it? They don't really have any particular dharmic insight. Maybe dogs do, because they're nicer than people mostly. But, you know, vows are really important in Buddhism. And we should see vows as things that protect us in the same way that, for example, if you had a small seedling, you might put something around it to protect it from rabbits or the deer or whatever, so it could grow. You know, you'd fertilize it and take care of it. In the same way, vows should be seen as ways to protect us as we grow from our infancy in the Dharma too. And the monks have like 300, the nuns have over 300, the monks have something like 200 and some vows, lots of vows. And to protect them from mindless behavior. Yeah, well, if you have a vow, are you married?
No.
Have you ever been married? Okay. Well, when you were married, I'm just going to assume the best here. When you have a vow to be married and to be with one person, and somebody starts flirting with you and you think, wow, this could go well if I wanted it to, or go badly, I should say. You know, you don't do that. You say, I have a vow. So the vow protects you from following your lust, your impulse for lust, you know? It's like that. Vows are just like that. If you have a vow to not kill, and you're presented with a situation where you have a small insect in the house, you might actually try to rescue it and take it outside rather than just smash it, you know? If you have a vow to not lie and the opportunity comes to fill out your tax return and you, oh gosh, I can't tell them about it. Uncle Sam's going to kill me. But, you know, we're planting seeds all the time. So vows are things that are meant to protect us from, you know, the impulses of egocentricity, I should say. The destructive ones, particularly. All right, so vows are really important. All right, the next stanza here. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Okay, so here we go into the bodhicitta. We're into the realm of the greater scope now. Now, you cannot get enlightened without bodhicitta. Right? Bodhicitta, bodhi means awakening, citta means mind. So it's often translated as the awakening mind, the mind of enlightenment, and so on. So there's a lot of different translations of that term, but I mean, bodhicitta is kind of easy because you kind of understand what it means once you've studied a little bit. And it's saying here, so everybody's in the same mess. We're all in samsara. We're all caught in the cycle of uncontrolled causation, death, rebirth, death, rebirth, death, rebirth. And we've done it countless times. And we've always been alone, you know. Nobody can go with us. We're doing this alone. We're doing our little thing over and over again. And we've suffered countless lifetimes. And we're all in this the same. And we're all the same in that way. So he says, so have all mother migratory beings. Mothers means, this has to do with, and I'll go in a minute, in past lifetimes. This is one of the ways we try to develop bodhicitta, is try to remember that everybody has been like family. Everybody has been in every potential relationship with us, friend, enemy, and so on. But we focus on the most important, for most of us, the most important relationship in terms of warmth and intimacy and all that is the one we have with our mom. So they use the word, son of all mother migratory beings. So mother migratory beings, all the sentient beings in samsara have been my mother in a past lifetime. That's meditation number two on the board. Seeing all sentient beings as having been mom. Okay?
What do they mean by migratory? Is that the...
Yeah, in cyclic, in samsara. Cycling in samsara. Death, you know, because of ignorance, we go through the cycle of birth and life and sickness and old age and then death again, and we do that over and over again. And it's a cycle of uncontrolled causation because we don't have the wisdom. The way you break the cycle is through developing wisdom. The wisdom of reality is the only way. There are 12 places to break it, but the really only way you can break it is through correctly understanding reality. And when you do that, you break that cycle and you achieve nirvana. That's the basis of nirvana and enlightenment, basically. All right? So, stand up for a minute, everybody, just stretch. And we're going to do a meditation on bodhicitta. And while you're standing, I'm just going to give a quick explanation of this. This is, this particular, so there were two strains of teachings on bodhicitta. One came down from Nagarjuna, and one came from Atisha. Pretty sure that's, no, Shantideva and Atisha. Yeah. Atisha did one called the six causes and one effect, which is basically seeing all sentient beings as mother, remembering their kindness, wishing to repay their kindness, great love, great compassion, supreme wish, which is I take personal responsibility for liberating all sentient beings, and then generating bodhicitta. And in Shantideva, his way of developing bodhicitta had to do with seeing the equality of self and others, in the sense that we're all similar in terms of wanting happiness and wanting to avoid suffering. So that's what that's about. And then remembering the faults of self-cherishing selfishness, and then the great benefit of cherishing others. From the Buddhist perspective, that is the cause of happiness, is cherishing others. Because for the most part, if we cherished others, we truly cherished others, we wouldn't kill them, would we? We wouldn't steal from them. We wouldn't cheat on them. We wouldn't lie. We wouldn't slander. We wouldn't disrupt their peace of mind with harsh speech or waste their time with gossip and idle gossip and frivolous speech and then greed, hatred, and ignorance. I don't know how to explain it, but you get the point. Cherishing others is the cause of happiness. Self-cherishing, the cause of all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time until now, is caused by one demon, the self-cherishing selfishness. We've got to remember that. That's the devil, so to speak. And then exchanging self with others is a meditation where we're going to do this in just a minute, but where you imagine that now, right now, I have the label Don, okay? But I'm going to imagine that I put that label on you. On everybody here is Don, and now I'm others. Okay? I'm others. So I'm going to treat Don a lot better than I treat others. But wait a minute, this is getting a little confusing because I'm others too. So this is a method that we use to develop our minds. So we get up in the morning for who? For others. We take care of our health for others. We do the best job we can for others. You know, we drive carefully, you know, for others. We live our life for others. Okay? Which is antithetical to what? Self-cherishing. Antithetical to self-cherishing. So that's what we have to do to develop bodhicitta. Because that's the ultimate antidote to selfishness. Which is our worst enemy. So we have to, you know, so this is a graded way to do it. This combines, you know, these two lines of Atisha and Shantideva's into one big meditation. And then taking and giving. We don't have time to do that tonight, but it's called Tonglin, taking and giving. It's a beautiful practice where where you imagine taking on the suffering of others and giving them happiness. And the person you usually start with is who? Yourself. So when you're sitting in meditation and you're doing Tonglin practice, you imagine yourself. Maybe as a, you know, at a time in your life when you were struggling. It could be now. It could be when you were like 6 years old. It could be some painful memory you have. You visualize yourself there and you try to sense, like, what was it like to be me? What is it like to be me? And imagine that suffering, you know, kind of leaving your body in the form of black smoke or black cloud and coming into your body now and destroying your selfishness, and then you send back light, you know, happiness everlasting. It's very much like what I imagine, you know, I've thought about this because, you know, Jesus, Easter's right around the corner too. So Jesus dying on the cross, you know, his thing was like, I'm taking on the suffering of the world, am I right? And I'm giving back everlasting life. I said, that's Tonglin. That's Tonglin. I think he was trying to teach people Tonglin, but they didn't get it. But maybe they did. Maybe that's what this, but I think that's Tonglin, where we imagine we take on the suffering, which is the action of, what is that? What do we call that? Compassion. Taking on the suffering of others, compassion. So, Tonglin is developing compassion. Giving others happiness is what? Love. Compassion, love. Compassion, love. So we're training ourselves when we do Tonglin practice, starting with ourselves and then moving on to others. You know, others are just infinite beings, right? So it's really good to work with specific people, too. Okay? So, and then the supreme wish. This one's really outrageous. This is an attitude that we, if it could be done, it would have been done. But what we say is, I am personally Robbie Watkins. No, let me pick on Joanna. Joanna Smith is personally responsible for the happiness of all sentient beings throughout all space and time. And so are you, Tony. And so are you, Ron. And so are you. And so are you. We're all. So that's what we want to develop. Personal, it's not Lama Zopa's or Geshe Galek's or Robbie's or Don's or anything. It's my responsibility to liberate all sentient beings from suffering and guide them to supreme enlightenment. It's called the supreme wish. It's an attitude. It's like I am personally responsible for everybody. Now, I usually get some assistance about here. caregiver burnout kind of stuff. I've been sacrificing my whole life for my mom or my kids or whatever, and, you know, what is this all about? This is an attitude that's based on love and compassion, not on some sentimentality, and it's not based on empathy. We talked about that the other night, how that leads to burnout. It's based on real, genuine love and compassion for all beings. So then we develop, then this supreme wish kind of just springs up. You know, if you really saw everybody as like your dearest family member, if you saw everybody as dear, and if you had the ability, wouldn't you want to guide them from suffering to happiness? Of course you would. So that attitude is the supreme wish. And then the next one is called Generation of Bodhicitta, and it's that we realize we don't have the ability. As much as we want to do it, we can't do it because we haven't trained ourselves. We haven't eliminated our faults and developed our qualities to the full, you know, to the full extent. So we, you know, one of my teachers, one teacher named Jeffrey Hopkins. You can sit down. You know, he said, "There's only one reason to get enlightened, and that's to help others. If you all you wanted was your own happiness, you would have got off the train at Nirvana. Because you're happy. You're blissed out. You have no problems. You know, just like Nguimala gets stoned, you know, when he goes to the marketplace, you know, he's bleeding and all banged up, but his mind's happy. It's like that. So, enlightenment, you know, the goal is to help others. And the method to do this is to develop our heart and mind and eliminate our faults and develop our good qualities. And so then we have the six practices of a bodhisattva, right? And they're sometimes called the six perfections. And the first one is usually translated as ethics, much. Generosity, sorry. What doesn't matter. There's just six of them. But anyway, generosity is the first one. Generosity is, you know, there's different ways to be generous. If you brought your checkbook tonight, there are donation boxes all throughout the center. I don't know how that happened. But there's plenty of opportunities to be generous. But it's not just material generosity, but it's being, giving protection, okay? Like being the kind of person that when other people are around you, they know they're not going to get hurt. Or if somebody is being bullied, you know, you're going to step in and try to help them. You know, even if it costs you, even if it's a little dangerous, you know, you might be willing to step up. So that's really generous, isn't it? And then giving the Dharma is another kind of generosity. So there's generosity, and then there's ethics. Okay, and then there's patience. Also, patience and tolerance are kind of the same thing. Although we think of patience as antidote to anger, right? Tolerance is also being able to put up with the hardships that come along with spiritual practice. So there's tolerance and patience are sort of merged in this perfection. Then there's enthusiastic perseverance. It's like energy, like the energy to practice, the energy to persevere through, you know, tough times and to try to use every bit of your life's experience as an opportunity to wake up and as part of your Dharma practice. And then, so those four, let's see, generosity, ethics, patience, and enthusiasm, you know, those are sort of the last two have to do with, you know, developing wisdom and actually, you know, concentration, which is like a laser-like mind. The first four are like a method, and the last two have to do with wisdom, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I've read that anyway. Yeah, so developing a really like laser-like mind. So it's concentration. And the term is calm abiding. It's like the mind can rest on any object, just like a laser can go deeply into any object it chooses to focus on without any distraction. Okay? And then wisdom is the wisdom of emptiness. So those are the six perfections that a bodhisattva practices with bodhicitta motivation. Okay? That's the key. And the bodhisattva practices these six perfections, and they're included in the bodhisattva vows. There's 18 root and 40-some secondary vows. But the bodhisattva vows are basically the six perfections and how to practice them in daily life. So it's something you can study. Okay, so that's what we're talking about when talking about the bodhisattva vows with great energy. And the three types of morality, three types of morality are avoid evil, do good. No, avoid evil, do good, help others. No, avoid evil, be positive, practice virtue, and benefit others. Those are the three types of morality. All right, now let's read the next one. no, wait a minute. That's it, isn't it? Clearly recognizing. I didn't read that one, did I?
Even if I develop
off only Bodhicitta.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the commentary before you, right?
See, I got a different translation. I'm sorry. This is the one from the text. What? Yeah, I've got that one. I've got that one here. Even if I develop bodhicitta without the practice in three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to this bodhisattva vows with great energy. Okay, good. So that covers all of that. Now let's read the next one. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream unified path of calm abiding and special insight. So, I just so calm abiding is the focused mind, concentrated mind, and special insight. Also, the Sanskrit term for calm abiding is shamatha. And the term, you hear this word all the time, vipassana. And that means penetrative insight. Penetrative insight into what? Into the nature of reality. So these are the crucial points that need to be realized to become an arhat and to leave cyclic existence. All right? Now, moving along. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. Alright, now that's tantra, okay? And that's having become a pure vessel by training in the general path. So that's the three principal aspects of the path. Renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view of emptiness, reality. Then bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, which is the Vajrayana or tantric path, and I've already talked about that earlier. But that's the this text covers that just a little bit. So the next little bit about it, the next bit is about Vajrayana, and I won't spend much time on it. All right, let's read this again. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I've become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. All right. So, in I never knew what these two attainments were, but in this text, Kuta Lama says what they were. He said the two attainments are general realizations and then the realization of emptiness. That's what those two attainments are. And in keeping vows, now. You know, I mentioned, the five lay vows that we talked about earlier, and there's seven vows, and there's, this, and we sometimes we take the eight Mahayana precepts. They're like eight vows it will take for 24 hours and stuff like that. Different sets of vows that we take. So it's important to keep your vows. You know, even if it's for 24 hours, as much as possible. It's worth doing to come and do that ceremony one time and realize how mindless we are. About halfway through the day, go, oh my God, I've been eating all day long and I said I was going to eat one meal or little things that we do. We exaggerate, and that's lying, isn't it? Exaggeration is a kind of lying. It's distorting reality. So there's ways that we can easily break these vows, and we have to. But it said it's admonishing us here to keep these vows. And if you practice, if you enter the Vajrayana path, you've not only had to take you've had to take Buddhist refuge vows. So you have to be a Tibetan Vajrayana. Requires that you have a commitment to Tibetan. I mean, to be a Buddhist, right? That's not surprising. And then to take the next step would be to take the Bodhisattva vows. So to enter the Vajrayana, you take the Bodhisattva vows, and then in highest yoga tantra, there's a whole another set of tantric vows. Interestingly, you're not supposed to even study those until after you've taken the empowerment in Hashoka Tantra, because they're supposed to be secretive. But they're not, it's not that big a secret. But it's the point is that they're even more demanding. The further you move up the ladder in terms of Vajrayana, the more demanding these vows are, the more it requires that you pay attention to your mind, and the harder it is to keep them. And so you don't throw your vows out when you get into Tantra. Doesn't go that way. It's really important to keep the vows. Never give up. Yeah, okay. And pledges. So samaya is like your sacred word of honor. So if you take an initiation in the Green Tara, you come here and some lama's giving an initiation. He says, "All right, for the rest of your life, I'd like for you to say, you know, Tara's mantra 21 times." Well, you know, you might do that for a week, and then you go, "Oh, I forgot yesterday." And then I forgot today. Well, I'll do a couple today. And then 5-6 months from now, you're not doing them anymore. That's called giving up your samaya. Your samaya is your sacred word of honor. And almost every tantric empowerment comes with some kind of commitment. And so it's important, to the best of our ability, to try to keep that commitment. So that's what he's saying. If you can keep your vows and your sacred word of honor, a lot of times the commitment is to do a particular visualization practice of that deity. For example, if I was going to do Tara, I would do a sadhana, which is a little booklet, literally, or a little text. It's called a method to actualize that deity. You do a sadhana every day of Green Tara. If you really wanted to do that, the teacher might say, "Well, I want you to do a sadhana practice." So that's what I mean. The samaya can be a little bit or it can be a lot. All right, then we'll move along here. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never give up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. So, the importance of the two stages. So this is, the two stages refer to Hashoka Tantra. And in Hashoka Tantra, there are four kinds of tantra. There's kriya, or action, charya, or performance, yoga, or yoga tantra, and there's highest yoga tantra, also called Mahanatara yoga tantra. So, we're talking about highest yoga tantra, and that's all. At least in the Gelugpa tradition, I think in Tibetan Buddhism in general, there's an emphasis on trying to practice at the highest level. Even though it's understood that you're not going to be able to, very few people are going to be able to make a lot of progress, having those seeds in your mind are really important for your future lives. So to get those empowerments and to try your best to put real seeds on your mind are important. So the two stages refer to the generation stage and the completion stage of Hashoka Tantra. The generation stage would be likened to a flower, and the completion stage would be likened to the fragrance of the flower. Okay, they're not the same thing. But the generation stage prepares you for the completion stage practices. And when somebody is ready to has done the proper preparation in the generation stage of Hashoka Tantra, the completion stage can go very quickly, and they can achieve extraordinary. Because in Tantra, I didn't say this too, but you're also, particularly in Hashoka Tantra, now you're no longer working with conceptual mind. You're working with the energies in the psychic energies, which is very difficult to explain because I don't understand it myself. But there are energies in Kundalini and working with these energies to purify the mind. There's also a lot of blissful energy associated with these, working with these energies, bliss. Does anybody like bliss? Everybody likes bliss. So if you can focus a blissful awareness on ultimate truth, you are going to make a lot of progress fast. Because your mind's not going to want to go anywhere. You're not going to, it's not going to wander off to the state fair and, you know, and job tomorrow. Like, you're blissed out, focused on reality. That's a very powerful practice to be able to access that kind of mind and then use it to become enlightened. And Hashoka Tantra specializes in you know, the utilization of bliss and emptiness in the same moment of mind. Okay? And the last one, maybe it's not the last one. Wait a minute. Where are you now? Now I'm just... That's the Vajrayana. Yeah. Set my vows and put every look four sessions. Please bless me to realize the teaching of the Guru. Yeah, now we're down to the last two stanzas. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. So outer hindrances would be like our enemies. You know, inner hindrances would be like illness and mental disturbance and things like that. By the way, this is one of the reasons why it's emphasized in Buddhism, and particularly in Vajrayana Buddhism, the tantric path, to not say anything, not make a big deal about it. It's a personal thing. You know, your spiritual practice is a personal thing. You don't go around, you know, making a big deal about it or, you know, trying to make an ostentatious show about it. That said, to just create all kinds of obstacles, both inner and outer obstacles. And you can imagine how that might work. And the last line, in all our lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So here we are. Again, this whole prayer is about planting seeds, isn't it? So in all our lives, we don't ever want to be separated from perfect gurus. So we're making that supplication. Well, that plants the seeds for what? For us to be, to make connection with the perfect gurus. May I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. Again, we're making that request. We're planting that seed, and it should ripen. It will ripen. this is why. Kuna Lama Rinpoche says it, but I'll read it, what he says. Well, I can't find it, but he basically says we have to, you know, we really have to have an unshakable faith in the laws of cause and effect, in karma, to really go anywhere on this path. That we are, you know, to be aware all day, every day, that we're planting seeds every, and you know, and as much as a finger snap. Robbie talked about 60 mind moments in a finger snap, right? And we're planting many, you know, seeds constantly all day long. And now, right now, tonight, billions of seeds are ripening, right, for us to be here in Kadampa Center, and we're planting more, and it's a dynamic process, planting these seeds for our future happiness. So, in all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma by completing the qualities, the stages and paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Vajradhara is like the big Buddha. But he's the tantric aspect of the Buddha, of the enlightened mind. And usually he's blue in color and he has consort and like that. But it's not like in Tantra, when there's a male and female deity in union, it's not like there's a he and a her. It's more like that's the deity, you know, it's both. It's not like a female and a male. It's like the union of bliss and wisdom in the same moment of mind. So, Vajradhara is, you know, the manifestation of the tantric manifestation of the Buddha in its highest form. All right. Any questions?
Are all the other deities manifestations of Vajradhara?
Yeah, Vajradhara is, you know, it's like, yeah, yeah. I'm not sure about that. I mean, you hear that, Robbie, but it's hard for me to say that. I'm gonna say yes, probably. Yes, what is the word I'm looking for here? Yeah, I'm definitely sure about that. Trust me on that one. No. All right, so I want to go over a couple of things. Let's stop for a minute and take a breath. So any questions about this discussion we've had? Yes. Oh yeah, no, actually it's a good question. Normally the day is divided into 4 6-hour sessions. So for example, sometimes it's divided into 6 4-hour sessions. So there's, for example, there's a 6-session guru yoga, which is a practice that people who take their tantric commitment seriously do, and if they do it right, every 4 hours, 24 hours a day, they do this little practice that takes about 3 minutes. And it's a rehearsal for the dying process and to access the subtlest level of mind and in meditating on emptiness. So you're actually creating a very subtle blissful consciousness in meditating on emptiness. So, usually if you do a meditation retreat, you have 4 sessions. One before the sun comes up, then one after breakfast, and then one in the early afternoon, and then one in the evening. That's generally the layout of a big retreat, you know, where you're doing a deity practice like for a month or 6 weeks or longer. Yeah. Hey, they're on here. They should be. Oh my gosh. Okay, 8 freedoms. All right, so I can tell you what I remember. The freedoms are freedom from being born as a hell being, as an animal, as a hungry ghost, with imperfect senses. How many is that? 4. Barbarian. Oh, you got it? You want to read them? All right. Barbarian, you know, blah, 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 blah. Thank you. All right. Being born in the hell realm, hungry ghost, animal, long life god. That's the deva realm. A long life god. Yeah, you don't want to be born. That's like being born living inside the Beltline. You know, where you got it made. You know, there's Glenwood South. There's restaurants everywhere. Most people are cool. Your neighbors are cool. And you know, anything you want, you know, there's plenty of dope inside the Beltline. There's plenty of everything. Sex. I mean, the God realm is this realm where you just have everything you can ever imagine at your fingertip. The bad news about the God realm is they live for 1,000 years, but the last 7 days of their lives, they realize they're going to die and they've used up all their good karma. And all their friends want to get away from them because now, although they used to smell really good, now they begin to stink. And nobody wants to be around them. And they see they're going straight to hell, and because they've used up all the good karma, and they suffer more in the 7 days before they die than a hell being suffers in an eon in the hell realms. Doesn't sound good, does it? Don't sell your house inside the Beltline, but You know, I always joke about that. But, you know, long life God. Freedom from being born at a time when a founder Buddha has not appeared. So, the Shakyamuni Buddha was the fourth of 1,000 great teaching Buddhas, right? In this great eon. So we could have been born at a time when the teachings were not available. That'd be easy, right? If you were born 2,600 years ago or 2,700 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to hear the Dharma. Freedom from being born in a place where there's no Dharma. Freedom from being born with defective senses. Freedom from holding wrong views. All right? And then the 10 endowments. You're born a human. Born in a religious country where you can practice, you've got all your bodily functions are intact, you haven't committed any of the 5 heinous crimes, killing your mother, your father, you know, drawing the blood of a Buddha, killing an, you know, the bad ones, you know, the really bad ones. Having faith in the Dharma is one of the 10 endowments. Being born when a Buddha's appeared, when a Buddha not only appeared, but taught. Because every time it's said that sometimes Buddhas come down, you know, show up and they go, there's nobody here that can understand this. I'm out of here. So they'll check out. They won't teach. They'll only teach if they feel that the teachings could be understood. Being born when the Dharma exists and flourishes, which it does now, being born at a fortunate period when we're able to meet with pure followers of the teachings, which we can, and born in a fortunate period when practitioners can enjoy support. So that means benefactors and supporting the center and all of that. So, you know, if you don't have a precious human rebirth, most of these 8 leisures we all have. You know, maybe wrong views, but most of them we have. The 10 endowments, we could have. I mean, maybe you don't, if you don't have faith in the Dharma, you know, things like that, you don't have one. But we both, you know, but you might want to create the causes for a PHR. Thank you for this. All right. So, it's good to memorize this. I had forgotten some of them. All right. So, I want to do that bodhicitta meditation that everybody goes. But before we do that, I just want to touch on the thing on emptiness. You know, I remember one time long ago I asked Lama Zopa, you know, what's the most important things to teach? And he said, emptiness and the lamrim. You know, bodhicitta basically. He said emptiness and bodhicitta. And so I wanted to say something about emptiness and then we'll be bodhicitta. But, you know, I think everybody, you know, knows that this selfing has disturbed this class multiple times during this last couple of months. But everybody knows this is a selfing, right? We're all clear about that. And you know it's a selfing because it. Yeah, because we've seen them before and people have told us that they were cell phones. It's pretty easy to see that we have the imprint in our mind to identify this as a cell phone. But if you had never seen this before, or if you were a baby or a dog or an animal, they wouldn't see a cell phone, would they? Right? So the cell phone-ness of this comes from none other than our own mind. Projecting cell phone. But, in fact, it looks like the cell phone is here, doesn't it? It looks like the cell phone is coming here and going into your mind. But, in fact, we're going projecting cell phone onto this collection of parts. There is no cell phone out here that exist independent of our mind, right? Projecting and labeling it. So there is no inherently existent, permanent, self-existent, all these words you hear, existing from its own side. Yeah, it doesn't exist from its own side. It, For its very existence, it depends upon a consciousness that labels it. For its very existence, it depends upon a consciousness that labels it. Our consciousness creates our world. Our consciousness creates the walls, the ceiling. Remember I told about how karma ripens, right? It ripens in everything is karma. Now, you know, we have the collective karma to see ourselves in this building, right? This building doesn't create karma. We create, our minds create the karma to be forced to see ourselves in the Kadampa Center in a place with these people and these walls. It's karmic seeds ripening. That's how reality works. There's no objective reality out there that exists independent of our mind labeling it, our mind projecting it. And so we want to see ourselves as happy, don't we? We want to see our world working. We want to see a place where people are peaceful and happy, and particularly this one. You know, we want to be happy. And so it's all about the seeds. It's all about the seeds. We've got to plant the seeds. We will not wake up tomorrow and things be hunky-dory. It'll look a lot like today because we have, it's a continuity of this mind that's confused. But if we want to have a better day tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next year and the years to come, we have to create those causes tonight and tomorrow and every moment, right? Because remember, karma is always rolling, changing, expanding, ripening continuously. That's really important. We pay attention. So emptiness fundamentally means that what we thought existed out here independent of our mind is not there. Remember my little Venn diagram last time? We've got, here's reality, and here's our projection, and they get skewed on top of each other. You know? And the correct view of reality is to get rid of our projection and see things as they are. We strip away our projection and see things as they are. It doesn't mean that things stop existing or functioning. It just means that our projection, which is generated by ignorance and our egocentricity, is mistaken. So we have to begin to question the reality that appears in front of us all the time. Question. That's what, at a very basic level for us beginners, understanding emptiness, just intellectually beginning to question that appearances are real, that there's only one way to see this, that that person really is an enemy and is a jerk, and they deserve to go down because I see it that way. To have a question that maybe there's another way to look at them or another way to look at the situation. This is how we can work with the understanding of emptiness. There is no reality independent of our mind creating it. Okay? Now, let's finish up with a little bodhicitta and won't take much time. I'll just go through those points quickly. Again, the big difference between the Mahayana and other sort of streams of Buddhism, and I think it's the thing that attracts people to this center anyway, is I think people understand that we're not in this thing alone, that we're all in this thing together, we're all interconnected, interdependent, and that you know, my happiness and my suffering, your happiness and your suffering, that they're not, you know, they don't happen in a vacuum. We're all interconnected. And so it's in my personal interest to help others. I want to live in a world where people are happy. I want to be part of that. You know, so the goal is bodhicitta that we're aiming to develop is this goal that we really do want others to be happy and have the causes of happiness, and that for us to really be able to do to help along that lines, along that path, we have work to do on ourselves. We have a lot of work to do, and it will take time. It's not a quick fix, but it's definitely worth the effort. So the first meditation on this is equanimity, and it's just being able to, you know, we generally say seeing you know, because we're trying to develop loving compassion, love and compassion for all beings, so we can't discriminate. Well, there's my friend, and there's my, you know, there's an enemy, and there's somebody that I don't even know. I don't even care about them. So the friend, the stranger, and the enemy, we try to develop a sense of equanimity or equanimous attitude. And there are different ways to do this, but I think the easiest one to think about right now is that these things are so changeable. These are just labels. The friend could become the enemy. The enemy could become the friend. The stranger could become the enemy or the friend. They're impermanent labels. And we get so hooked on our labels. So we try to develop this foundation for bodhicitta is equanimity. Not holding some as close and others distant, as that stanza talks about. And then we meditate on seeing all sentient beings as our mother. That, you know, and the thinking being that from beginning this lifetimes we've had all different potential relationships, so we choose this most, the one that for most people is the one where they receive the most generosity and kindness. Not only their in that, but their body, our very body. You know, our mom cared us for 9 months and showed us amazing kindness. But what we want to see here is seeing all sentient beings as mother. So label, you know, you could actually label everybody. Lama Yeshe used to call everybody dear. Dear. I think that was his method of trying to, of seeing everyone as like mother. Kind, sometimes called kind mother sentient beings. So we want to be able to see everybody. And our mother of this life has been our mother in many past lifetimes, and will again be our mother in future lifetimes. And we will be her mother in future lifetimes. And then we remember the kindness of the mother. So, you know, it's the kindness of whoever brought you up and showed you the most kindness. Because some people weren't brought up by their biological moms, and, or they had a strained relationship with her. But the point is to feel a real sense of appreciation and love in your heart for your mom of this life, and then to extrapolate that to all of your other mothers, beings that have been mothers in past lifetimes. We just don't remember. You know, we look around the room, we see all these faces of people, different ages, they look different. We think, you know, but at some point in the past, every one of us has had that most intimate relationship with each other. And I'm asking you to creatively align with this. Not like I can prove it, but just to see how that affects your mind. And then, the next step is the desire, the wish to repay the kindness of all mothers. So it's not somebody else's job, it's my responsibility to repay the kindness of all my kind mother sentient beings. And then the next step is the equality of self and others. And so normally we think, well, I'm the most important one, right? Or we think, well, I is one and others are infinite. But others actually seem like one too, don't they? Others are infinite. And these infinite others are just like me in one really, really important way. Everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. From the tiniest insect, you know, up to the biggest mammal, you know. Every sentient being wants the same thing. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. And in that really important way, we are the same. And then we remember the faults of selfishness, self-cherishing selfishness, and the great value of cherishing others. And then we reflect on exchanging self for others. And what we're really exchanging is self-cherishing for cherishing others. But we can use this method of labeling others, you know, labeling ourselves as others, you know, get up in the morning for others, take care of others, work hard for others, do everything for others, because, you know, we have to get this obsessive self-cherishing, selfish focus. We've got to begin to dismantle that. So we're exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others. And then the Tonglen we talked about, taking on the suffering, the action of compassion, giving happiness, and is the action of love. And then the supreme wish is I take, you know, you have to, and again, this is not a Napoleonic, egocentric, you know, whatever you, what's the word, I don't know, but it's just, Robert Thurman calls it a messianic vow. It sounds too technical for me, but it's like, it's based on genuine love and compassion, not sentimentality. And it's not just for the people that are near and dear to you. It's for every living being. Every living being. We think, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all beings throughout all space and time. And I will personally guide them from whatever state of confusion wherever they are, I'm going to guide them from that all the way to supreme enlightenment. That's what I'm committing to. Because they are family. You know, this is based on love and compassion. They are part of the family of living beings that want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And then, the last is the awakening mind. It's where we say, okay, I want to do this, but I can't do it unless I do the work. Clean up my messes and develop my good qualities. Clean up my negative mind, my depression, my stress, you know, whatever it is. You know, work on purifying and eliminating our faults and our negative mind states and cultivating bodhicitta, correct view of emptiness, compassion, loving kindness, patience, all the six perfections we talked about. Really working on our mind because it can be transformed. It's not static. It's not. We're not working with a brick here. We're working with something that's changing constantly, and it can be transformed into the mind of enlightenment with the right training and the right effort. Okay, so let's do a dedication. Chandi Deva's dedication. Okay. Yeah, I'd just like to thank everybody for hanging in here. This is, you got other things to do, and you showed up and paid attention, and I don't know how many people were able to do practices at home, but still, you know, I mean, for me, it's a great honor to be able to teach these classes, because it forces me to think about these things that I find so helpful, and I really do think that, you know, we have planted a lot of good seeds. We have been doing some serious gardening. I don't know, maybe bigger than that. And those seeds, I really believe this, that those seeds will ripen. Hopefully in this life, but definitely at some point in the future. They definitely will, and this is a good way to think, they definitely will ripen. And the ripening happiness and the causes of enlightenment. So let's do these dedications with that in mind. May all beings everywhere plagued by sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. Thank you.